Good morning, everyone. We're going to get started. And our TMR member, George Kilpatrick, is going to introduce our speaker this morning.
Thank you and good morning. Dubbed a pop culture ambassador by the Associated Press, Robert Thompson has contributed to hundreds of radio and TV programs and publications. He's the founding director of the Bleier Center for Television and Popular Culture at Syracuse University, where he is also a trustee professor of television and popular culture at the S.I. Newhouse School of Public Communications. Bob was a visiting professor for 6 summers at Cornell University and served for 9 years as professor and director of the NHSI Television and Film Institute at Northwestern University. Bob is the general editor of an ongoing series of books about television published by Syracuse University Press. He's the former president of the National Popular Culture Association and lectures across the country on the subject of television and popular culture. He was awarded the Stephen H. Coltran Award for Excellence in Communication Theory by the International Radio and Television Society in 1991 and 1992. Bob is the author or editor of 5 books and is currently working on a book, The History of Television. Hundreds of radio and TV programs and publications have featured Professor Thompson's commentary. He's really the go-to guy. This includes CBS's 60 Minutes, The Evening News with Dan Rather, NBC's Dateline, ABC's 2020, World News Tonight, Good Morning America, and even my show, Inspiration for the Nation. Bob holds a BA in political science from the University of Chicago and an MA and PhD in radio, television, and film from Northwestern University. Please join me in welcoming Professor Bob Thompson.
Thank you, George. I didn't know I was going to be introduced by the distinguished George Kilpatrick. And forget your recent show. We go back to when Dave Valesky was just little Dave Valesky. Yes. Before he became Mr. Big Shot. Anyway, thank you very much, George. Well, we started 20 years ago, the Center for the Study of Popular Culture, which is now called the Bleier Center for Television and Popular Culture. And I think one of the best ways to look at the current state of television and maybe its future is to actually go step back 20 years to when that began. And it is both amazing and alarming how much has changed in that 20 years. Most people 20 years ago still watched television on ye olde TV set in the living room. People were complaining that kids were watching too much TV. Now, in my classroom of 120 students or so, virtually none of them go home that night after class to a place with a television set. They watch it almost exclusively on their various portable devices. And while they're still watching a lot on that, it's completely fragmented as to what they're watching. So I thought you should go back and look at what happened in that last 20 years, and it's really kind of extraordinary, I think. First of all, just before 20 years ago, in 1996, 2 things happened, one in July and one in October of 1996. And if you cocked your ear to the air at that point, you could have heard civilization making major shifts at this point. And that, of course, was the introduction in July of 96 of MSNBC and the start of Fox News in October of 96. Now, cable news, 24-hour cable news, that was not a big, that had happened a long time ago. CNN was introduced back in 1980 in the emerging cable environment. And though none of us took it seriously at the time, how could this little operation from Atlanta, run by a guy who always wore a cowboy hat, how could this take on the likes of CBS, the house that Murrow built, and all the rest of it? But within a couple of years, CNN started becoming almost a generic term like Kleenex or Band-Aid. When breaking news happened, you went on to CNN. However, CNN did pretty much old school journalism. They used a lot of the old standards and principles of good reporting. It wasn't the star system. For many years in CNN, Larry King was the only recognizable name. And part of that was because they had the territory all to themselves. They were the only one doing 24-hour cable news. Once all of a sudden that becomes two-way race, and then a couple months later, a three-way race, that's a whole different story. So starting in 1996, we have as many 24-hour news networks, three, as we used to have for most of the history of television networks in general, three. And once that happens, news has to do other things. Remember, cable news is only competing for a really tiny slice of the population. We have, what, 330 million people, I think, in this country, something like that. If you add up the total number of people watching all of CNN, MSNBC, and Fox on any given night, it's probably less than 1% of that population. So you really have to go after that crowd. And that meant doing kinds of things that would maximize your audience so you could maximize your advertising income. And cable news started to then get crazy from the kind of sober CNN. All of a sudden, they had to do all these other things. And Fox figured out right in the beginning, very successfully, that people only watch 24-hour cable news when there's breaking news, a hurricane, an earthquake, a terrorist attack. What if we could make them watch it all the time? They weren't turning us on because they wanted to see breaking news. They wanted to see Hannity or O'Reilly or whomever. And that worked. They went to number one pretty quickly, and then all of these other news operations had to adjust. Consequently, we would get show coverage of things like the Bubble Boy. Does anybody remember this several years ago? A breaking news story that was wall-to-wall on all three networks about a kid who accidentally got caught in a balloon and went up into space, but of course there was no kid in the balloon. The whole thing was bogus, and after a few hours of complete coverage at the expense of other important things that may have been happening, everybody covered this with the idea that if they weren't covering it, you'd go to another channel. So that's 1996. Then there was also in late 1996 the Dancing Baby. Does anyone know what I'm talking about? This was the first internet viral video, which usually considered the kind of voice crying in the wilderness of the era of YouTube, though YouTube was many years in the future. And it was this computer-generated dancing baby, and then they added some music to it. And it also announced that now there was going to be a whole different kind of television. We had the professional stuff on network. We had the professional stuff on cable. But also now we were going to get a whole new range of programming. And even though a lot of it was cats playing pianos and cats using toilets and dogs dancing with or laying down with ducks and all that kind of stuff, there was other things that happened as well. So that really began to shift things also. And then we get to the very spring that we were putting together our center 20 years ago in 1997, DVDs get introduced. Now, what's interesting about this is 20 years ago, this spectacular new technology of DVDs gets introduced. Already today, 20 years later, when we're talking, the DVD is like ancient history. Pretty soon you're going to have to go to Colonial Williamsburg to watch a little spinning operation of how to make yarn and then how a DVD used to work. But still, that was a big deal because the DVD was the next step. The really big revolution, of course, was the VCR, which most of you probably remember. It came out in the late 70s. Most of us couldn't afford it until into the 80s. But people don't remember that that was the first time you could actually store television and film in a way that you could watch it when you wanted. When I was a kid, if I wanted to watch Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, I had to watch it when it played on December 7th or 8th or whatever, or I missed it for the rest of the year. I remember growing up hearing about Citizen Kane this, Citizen Kane that, the most wonderful movie ever made. You've got to see Citizen Kane. I can't believe you've never seen it. I wanted to see it. I had no opportunity. There was no such thing as a library of movies to go to. Maybe if you lived on a campus, they'd play it in one of their own retrospective things. But you pretty much had to wait till that stuff played on TV, or you had to read about it. I remember as late as 1977, the year I met my wife, walking down Michigan Avenue of Chicago, saying, "Very soon, we are going to be able to put movies on shelves, just like books, and watch them whenever we want them." But that didn't happen, really, until we moved into the 1980s. What the DVD did, of course, is it was so much smaller that now you could put television on these things in effective sorts of ways. There was television releases on VHS before, but it'd be a couple of episodes. DVDs now started releasing entire series, entire seasons, which gives way to binge watching, but also gives way to the idea that producers are now going to think about what they make with the idea that people are going to watch it and pay attention to it, like poets know about their poems or novelists about their novels. Also in 1997, in August, a little company, which most of you have probably heard of, called Netflix, develops. This is 1997 that it starts. And when it starts, of course, it wasn't the Netflix we know of today. It was actually kind of old-fashioned, and it's what ultimately killed Blockbuster. Netflix was based on a transportation model. It actually took DVDs and put them and delivered them to you on, again, the olden days U.S. Post Office. It was like the Pony Express technology of delivering material. But you knew they were ready to go further than that. The technology just wasn't available yet. It was called Netflix, which doesn't imply the mail truck coming. But most of you probably remember those red and white envelopes that you used to get the DVDs in and you'd send them back again. It seems so quaint. It seems so much like we should be wearing a tricorn hat. But it wasn't that long ago. Netflix starts in 97. 1999, TiVo, which is the first of the big popular DVRs, which then allows you, again, back in the VHS days, you could technically record stuff, but everybody remembers that 12-12-12, or everybody remembers the fact that you'd recorded the last 7 weeks of your favorite soap opera, but you had no idea what tape it was on, you had no idea what order to watch them in, you'd forgotten to rewind. There are thousands of stacks of VHS tapes in attics all around the country that nobody ever watched because they didn't label them. TiVo fixed all that. You push the little button, it says what you record, it recorded whatever you wanted to do. You could zip through the commercials, so it was a crisis to the advertising agencies. But even TiVo, even the DVR now has become a quaint sort of thing. YouTube doesn't start till 2005. Again, hard to believe something like this hasn't been around forever. And then the streaming video services, Amazon starts streaming some video in 2006, and Hulu and Netflix start streaming in 2007, and that puts us to where we are now and how so many people watch TV. So in that little period of time, we get this radical change in how people watch television. So that's kind of the technology. Now let's very briefly talk about the money involved. You all know about the law of gravity. Presumably Newton, Apple hit him on the head and he said Eureka and came up with the law of gravity. By the way, that is probably a completely false story. Fake news, sad. But he did develop the law of gravity, which said essentially what goes up must come down. But that was science, and we're talking about showbiz, and those are two completely different things. The law of gravity does not work with the distribution of television. The law of gravity in the distribution of television with regards to its prices is what goes up will continue to go up and will never come down and will always keep going up and up and up. And I think that's probably certainly what we're seeing and probably what we're going to continue to see. TV used to be free. It was a great business model in many ways because if movies were a rental idea where you would rent someone a little space, a seat in a theater, and the reason you'd pay such high rent for that little space for such a short time is they were going to put something in front of you that you couldn't see elsewhere. If books were about actually buying a physical copy of a book, TV was essentially about selling our attention spans, which, by the way, we didn't get paid for. They sold our attention spans to advertisers, and we tolerated that because we got to see free programs. But the great thing about the old free TV idea, free insofar as you had to buy a TV set, but free after that, was that you had some agency in that thing. As all of you know who grew up during the that network era, oftentimes when the commercials came on, you would what? Go to the bathroom, diaper the baby, check the pot roast, answer the phone, do your French homework, whatever it was, and you got all of this programming. Then cable came along, and while people still pulled stuff off the air, if you wanted all the good stuff, including CNN and ESPN and HBO and all that kind of thing, you had to get cable. I remember that my first cable package had 12 channels, and I thought that was so cool. 12 TV channels. This is how long will it take me to go through all of these different channels? My current cable box, when it's working, has lots more than that, obviously. And now, of course, we've got the cord cutters. I've talked to some of you before we started today, who have taken away their cable, and now you feel so smart, you're so liberated, you're saving so much money. But just wait. If you want to watch Game of Thrones, you got to get HBO Go. If you want to watch Orange is the New Black, you've got to get Netflix. If you want to watch the new Star Trek thing, you've got to get CBS All Access. And now they're going to do a Twilight Zone thing. And before you know it, that tiers of expenses that you used to have in your cable thing are going to start to stack up on these internet streaming services. It's just that you've put together the expensive body of stuff you're going to watch as opposed to one company doing it for you. So I guess there's a little more agency then. Unless, and I don't see too many people under 25 here, but unless you use the other, and I don't know how to do this either, the other alternative, which is to pirate it. And there's a lot of people watching television that way now. A recent study that just came out said that 2016, $37 billion in revenue from streaming video. That sounds about right. $26.7 billion of people who streamed it illegally. So $26.7 billion lost to piracy. That's a big percentage of the total amount of people who are watching this, and it's how a lot of people, in fact, do watch it. So that's this other option that people are constantly trying to come up with ways to get around. I have an awful lot of people I know who are avid fans of Game of Thrones, which is on HBO, and they have never paid for it, or are even using the codes of their parents or friends. They figure out how to watch it elsewhere. So that's sort of the financial stuff. But what I'm actually most interested in about television, and especially TV as it's going along recently, is TV as an art form. TV as something that we enjoy like we would a novel or a symphony or a painting. And that really begins to change about 20 years ago as well. In fact, in 1999, there were four extraordinary things happened, one right after the other in that year, that I think became kind of the table legs of the big change in television. First, on January 10th of 1999, was the debut of The Sopranos. Now, for a little background, television had back in the 40s and early 50s what was called the golden age of television. And the reason it was called the golden age of television was basically because snobs looked back at that period and they saw, ooh, television was based in New York. It was live. It was theatrical. And it was doing all these plays, Ibsen, Shaw. There was on network TV, one night in 1949, there were 4 adaptations of Shakespeare plays in one single week, network television. So everybody looked at that and called it the golden age of television, because in about 53 or so, TV packed up and moved to Los Angeles. That became a film aesthetic. It was done on, it was no longer live. It wasn't theatrical. Sitcoms took over live presentations and all that kind of thing. I've gone back and looked at as much of the golden age of television that still exists, and because it was live, not a lot of it is still around. And I have to say, it was a misnomer. There are about 9 or 10 hours of really, really golden age of television, and the rest of it is really, really hideous. If I would have first been introduced to Shakespeare, whose work I love dearly, but if I'd have first been introduced it by one of these live productions in early television, I would have probably never wanted to see a Shakespeare play again in my life. So when we say the golden age of television, I like to preface it with the so-called golden age in television. Then we had the second golden age of television, which I think really was golden. I wrote a book called The Second Golden Age of Television, which starts with a show called Hill Street Blues in 1981, which I suspect some of you have seen, which really, for the first time, demonstrated how ambitious artistically, aesthetically, from a literary standpoint, television could be. And it was followed by St. Elsewhere, still my favorite show of all time, Moonlighting, China Beach, 30-something, up through Twin Peaks, which became absolutely experimental through that decade. And the amazing thing was that this stuff was happening on commercially supported network TV. Everybody thinks HBO and AMC and FX started this. It didn't. When NBC was introducing the likes of Hill Street Blues and St. Elsewhere, when the networks were really maturing television in a significant way, HBO was just beginning to do series. One was called The Hitchhiker, which was kind of a poor man's Twilight Zone, where you could pretty much be guaranteed to see naked breasts at least twice per episode because they could do it. The other was a show called First and Ten, set in the football industry, starring Delta Burke and O.J. Simpson. You know that one had to be good. I mean, they were doing a lot of really kind of cheesy, sleazy sorts of things, with a couple of exceptions. HBO learned how to do quality television from NBC and ABC, not the other way, the other way around. Which brings us back to January 10th of 1999. HBO had learned it by this time. They'd done Oz before that, a few other things before that. And The Sopranos, I think, by anybody who has actually seen it and puts it in the context of the rest of the history of American storytelling, is a real masterpiece. From the very first seconds, when you look at that open, and anyone who's seen this can remember it, it is a beautiful 90-second pithy review of the American immigrant experience. It starts with a right down that you see the shot of the Statue of Liberty, the first generation of immigrants. Then you go through the vast wasteland of all that Jersey industry with the billowing smokestacks, the first job in a factory. Then you move into the urban areas with the pizza place and the muffler joint and the butcher, second generation, you know, you own your own business kind of thing. Then you move further into the suburbs, and there's three incredible shots, one right after the other, and each one shows the houses further apart and more trees in between each one. It is literally the American dream being progressed through in 90 seconds. And then it ends, of course, at the end of the American dream, an estate with a swimming pool out in the exurbs with lots of wood and a huge house and all that kind of thing. If The Sopranos had ended after its first 90 seconds, it would have been a really brilliant show. But it didn't. It went on to do all kinds of extraordinary things. And I think that's the symbolic announcement that we'd reached maybe what we could call a third golden age of television. And that was first all these shows on cable, you know, The Wire, Mad Men, Breaking Bad, and then moving in, of course, to the streaming things that Netflix and Hulu and the rest would do. By the way, since I started talking today, 9 Netflix new series have been introduced, and 9 more will be introduced before I finish. Every time a bell rings, Netflix introduces a series. And in many ways, a lot of these have been had a conversation with themselves. Breaking Bad, of course, was the next really kind of extraordinary thing, which played on basic cable. I always thought that if The Sopranos was about a really, really, really bad guy who is offered a chance at redemption, the beginning of the show, and he doesn't take it, Breaking Bad was about a really, really, really good guy who is offered a chance at damnation in the very first episode, and he takes it in a minute. There's a sense in which we can really look at these TV shows as becoming part of a literary tradition that we didn't really think of television as being before. That was the 10th of January, 1999. On the 11th of January, 1999, the very next day, Jon Stewart takes over from The Daily Show. Now, in the beginning, that wasn't a big deal. Before this, Craig Kilborn had been doing The Daily Show. This was during the Clinton impeachment. It was a frat boy kind of a comedy. And Jon Stewart continued that. There'd be erection jokes every 5 minutes on that show. It was kind of a raunchy whatever. But that begins to change, and especially by the time we get to the 2000 election, that's the Hanging Chad election, that show takes a totally different turn and really becomes a, not investigative journalism, but investigative comedy. The way they dealt with the movement into the war, when so much of journalism was very afraid to go into that, Jon Stewart's show was plowing into that in some really significant ways. And it became a college of for people who would go on to do important shows afterwards. Stephen Colbert, Steve Carell, Ed Helms, Olivia Munn, Hasan Minhaj, John Oliver, Larry Wilmore, who had a great show that ended recently, Samantha Bee. All of these came out of that Daily Show thing. I think that show, we can't overestimate its power. It became an important part of the civic conversation. It was doing things that were not being done elsewhere. And while I was always upset when people say, oh, all young people are getting their all their news from comedy, well, of course you shouldn't get all your news from comedy, just like you shouldn't put all your money in one place. But if they're getting some of their news from The Daily Show, I can think of a lot worse places for them to be getting it, and not a whole lot of places better. So that's 2 days that we get those two things happen. Then thirdly, in August of that year, Who Wants to Be a Millionaire comes out, becomes a huge hit, teaches networks that they can look overseas for programming that would become hits. And then the next summer, they introduce Survivor. And Survivor, of course, completely revolutionizes the way television would be done. It starts the reality explosion in a big way and in an interesting way. That show, anybody who watched that first season of Survivor, that was some very fine television. So we've got this high quality literary stuff, the new civic comedy, and then reality all happening in this little space in 1999. Then, of course, Netflix waits a little longer, but in 2013, they introduce House of Cards, now the very stigmatized House of Cards. But that was their second original programming, but the first one that got any attention. They followed it with Orange is the New Black, and now we've got this, I hate to be too hyperbolic, but Netflix today, in the second decade of the 20th century, reminds me of Florence in the 1400s. I mean, there is a lot of really exciting stuff going on there. And the other streaming service, The Handmaid's Tale from Hulu, got a whole passel of Emmys. So I think what we can see here is that television has made this real transformation, in some, artistically at least, in some really, really good ways. But I'll end by pointing out that when I was growing up, most of the shows we had were about talking horses, talking cars, my mother who was the car, flying nuns, witches, genies, and all of that. And I'm glad that we, and you couldn't say pregnant on the air, married couples slept in separate beds. I'm glad that we now have expanded this great medium of what television is to be able to tell some stories that are that may not be appropriate for just for eight-year-olds. But we have also lost something as well, which is this idea of consensus. This idea, I know when Walter Cronkite said, "And that's the way it is," that was ridiculous hubris. But it did provide this kind of middle ground where everybody sort of thought, okay, this is some stuff we can at least debate as truth. That's completely gone away. When I was a kid and I turned on the TV and the State of the Union was on, I didn't want to watch that. I turned the channel and the State of the Union was on. And I turned the channel and it was the State of the Union. So what did I do? I didn't want to turn off the TV. I hoped that the State of the Union would be short. So that, and then Happy Days would come on, which is what I wanted to watch in the first place. And therefore, I watched the State of the Union. And a lot of stuff like that happened. A lot of people changed their politics because they were forced into this weird oligopolistic middle. I'm not saying that's a good thing. I like having more voices. Having three networks dominate all knowledge is a difficult thing. But what we have now in this bounty of information, I think we have no idea how hard it may be to negotiate the world without that glue that we had for a century that made up American popular culture. You know, we call our thing the Center for the Study of Popular Culture. I don't know that we should add an S to that, because there is no such thing to popular culture anymore. There used to be 90 million people would watch a big event. If you wanted to watch Elvis or the Beatles on Ed Sullivan, you had to sit through a magician or the comic stylings of Mitzi Gaynor. Everybody had to watch this thing. There are episodes of the Beverly Hillbillies that got 65 million viewers. Now, I'm not meaning to celebrate that necessarily, but an episode of Mad Men got 2 million viewers. So we've got all this stuff, but all this fragmentation. We're really now a nation of popular cultures with an S, as opposed to popular culture, which is what we used to have, which was dominant. That's good news in an awful lot of ways, but as we look at the division, the complete lack of consensus on even what constitutes a fact, I think it's bad news in an awful lot of ways as well. That's all I got. Well, actually, I've got more, but my time is up.
You end up with where my question was going. This is a phone. This is an iPhone. Someone will tell you that it is an Apple. But this is an iPhone. My question is, where are we going with news?
Okay, first of all, about that CNN commercial you're referencing. What I love about that, or what I don't love about it, is that I understand what they're trying to do. You know, the facts are facts kind of thing. But do anybody here remember that Magritte painting, which said, it's a picture of a pipe, and it says, this is not a pipe. It's in French, but it says, this is not a pipe. And his point was, it wasn't a pipe. It was a painting of a pipe. The same is true of that CNN thing. When that thing shows up in my living room and says, this is an apple, it isn't an apple. I can't reach out and eat it. It's a image on a TV screen, which means the banana that it's not is no more an apple than the apple that it's not. So anyway, I think CNN needs to take a little more art history classes for that. This is, for those of you who don't know, CNN put out a commercial that said it has an apple, and it says, this is an apple. Some people are going to tell you that this is an apple, and they show you a banana, or that the apple is a banana, and they're going to put it in capital letters and whatever, but it's not a banana, it's an apple, whatever. It was kind of cute. Where does news go? Oh, that's a long... I mean, first, we've got one big problem, which is the business model, where when I started my career, there were so many journalists who I would get calls from every day who are not working anymore, and not because they retired, but because they were retired kind of thing, or fired, they're cut. So you've got the business model of how you pay for, because doing, you know, having a bureau in Baghdad and a bureau here and there is expensive, and that's the big problem, and we've seen newspapers go out of business and all the rest of it. So that's the number one problem facing people. But, you know, I'm a little optimistic about some of this stuff, because I think to some extent, all of the craziness of the past while has invigorated journalists. That CNN ad where they're kind of fighting back with that. The whole truth dies in darkness, Washington Post thing. The New York Times, facts are hard. I'm probably getting these paraphrased wrong. And for the first time, I've seen students... You know, back in the Woodward and Bernstein days, you'd had college students come in and they wanted to be Woodward and Bernstein. They wanted to fight the good fight. They wanted to tilt with windmills and all the rest of it. I haven't seen that in journalism students in a long time, but I'm beginning to see a little bit of it now where these battle lines have been drawn, and in some odd way, I think it's invigorated some journalists. Now, the question is, will they ever be able to get a job, and will the place they get it be able to pay them? That's a whole other other issue. But getting to how I had ended at, I knew people as a kid who were, this one guy I knew was a real bigot. And about 80 years old, he retires, and it's the time when Sally Jesse Raphael and Phil Donahue and all that kind of thing. And he watches these all day long after he retires. And one day, I hear somebody mention a transvestite, referring to a transsexual. And this guy gets all upset. You know, they don't like this. There's a difference between the two. He then defines it, and he said, they don't like whatever. And I realized that this guy had become a poster boy for political correctness. His bigotry had, like, dissolved. He'd seen some new kind of light. Because once he stayed home and watched Phil and Sally Jesse and whoever else was on at the time, he was exposed to a whole different way of thinking. That would never happen today, because when he retired, what would he be watching? He'd go home, he'd turn on Fox News, and he'd leave it on until he fell asleep. And that, I think, that's one of the advantages we used to have of the fewer voices. Now, there were a lot of disadvantages. Back in those days, think of all the different people who had, you never heard their stories. So I'm not only to celebrate ABC, NBC, and CBS, but that story of State of the Union and other things, haven't you had a place? I remember the 1972 Olympics. I was had a little black and white television, and we were on vacation, and only one channel came in, and I had no interest in the Olympics. I had no interest in watching this, but it was all that I could get, so I watched it. And I got into track and field that fall. I joined the track team. I mean, that really changed my life in significant ways. Who would ever have to do that today? Because of that phone you just pull up. By the way, I still have one of these. But, I mean, now you never have to be bored. And I think while boredom can sometimes be the nursery of criminality, it can also be the nursery of, you know, creating yourself and all the rest of it. And with that thing in your pocket, as long as it's hooked up to, as long as it's working, you never have to be bored. Matter of fact, you not only never have to be bored when you're not doing anything else, you never have to be bored when you're listening to a lecture or talking to a friend or whatever. I was telling George I had to have a zero tolerance on electronic devices in my class. If I even see one, 10% of your grade gets lopped off for first offense.
So
I say that with a little more pride than I probably should.
So a little bit of backstory. My uncle used to be the editor-in-chief of a very small paper back home, and he viewed the validity of information in a binary fashion, meaning it was either accurate or it wasn't. And if he wasn't confident that his reporters were 100% accurate and had investigated an issue to the fullest extent of their ability, he refused to publish it. He said, you either get the information right or it goes in the shredder and we never publish it. Now I have a friend who is an accurate investigative journalist online, and she manages a Rite Aid because she can't make a living doing that. My question is, do you see information or news agencies moving back towards a system of accuracy over rapid response?
Yeah. Well, I still think there's a number of journalistic operations who, for the most part, are still operating on those old school journalistic principles. And we can point to the exceptions. Dan Rather and his 60 Minutes to National Guard thing, Jason Blair at the Times. But I think for the most part, those those places are still operating on that old principle. But then you mentioned the other thing is that all those reporters are also having to blog constantly. They're constantly having to post stuff, as you pointed out. And that, I think, is anathema to accuracy sometimes because you've got to get it out. I mean, the idea that you need to keep churning that that stuff out. But, you know, you remember that headline, Dewey defeats Truman? I know it's not quite the same, but trying to get out an extra read-all-about-it edition has got similarities to constantly trying to put out a blog, even though one is perpetually happening as the other is limited. But I don't know. Overall, I'm hanging on to some hope that there will be institutions that can still do that. And the rarer they become, the more valuable they'll become. And maybe that means that they'll be able to continue to operate. Kind of like Super Bowl commercials. The rarer it is that you've got one program being watched by everybody, the more valuable that one program becomes. And that's why they're worth $5 million per 30 seconds now.
Good morning. Could you please speak to the issue of consolidated local news and whether or not younger people are even paying attention?
Well, I hate to put younger people in one big, giant category because there's lots of different kinds of people. If you were to ask if my students, most of whom are not local, are watching our local news, I would say most of them are probably not. The consolidation, it is disturbing when you turn on the television and the logos of three different stations appear on the one place. I remember calling, I think it was WSYR once upon a time, and the receptionist answers the phone and names all the different stations, and I could have gotten a sandwich in the time that it took her to get through them all. And that again gets to that issue of you want multiple voices, and because they'll dilute if one of them screws up. Local news, though, and I'm rambling here, is still the one thing that CNN is not going to do, Fox is not going to do, MSNBC is not going to do. So you really depend, I think, a community on those local news operations. I used to get a Post Standard in my paper box once every day. I don't get that anymore. And I think there are probably a lot of stories out there that don't get told. And we're starting to depend sometimes. Sometimes a blogger is the only one who's gone to the school board, you know, meeting. Mm-hmm. So I guess that's better than nothing, but.
I want to follow up on the previous question. I am really concerned about the quality of local news here. Two things that happened recently. One was that a local radio reporter, unfortunately, has passed away, an excellent guy. I'm listening to the news, and he said there's a woman on SYR reporting that a woman, they said Mendy Kletsky, and called that person a she. So I call up Kevin, and I say, you know, just to let you know, Mendy, that woman reporter that you were anchoring, she got it wrong, and it's a he. And he said, he wrote it, she was just reading it. So I'm concerned about the whole issue of he got the information from our print report paper. So there's a big issue. Secondly, during the recent election, there was a reporter covering the mayoral election, and he had factual information wrong in a story. I sent him an email, and I said, you're quoting the wrong numbers. And he said, oh, well, I made a mistake. I'll do something about it. Well, the way he did something about it is later on he sort of, took it out, really, of the story. And it had to do with the issue we all heard about was how many police officers there really are in the budget. And I'm just really concerned. And then later in a debate, Dan Cummings uses the facts from our local newspaper. So I've been here 30 years, dealt with the media through my job. I'm really concerned about the quality of our local reporting, the accountability of our local reporting, and I feel bad for them. They don't have, I'm concerned.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose there's two things. One is, I think we always should be concerned about local reporting, and I think no matter what market you go into, you're going to find that. People are going to be, you know, their various level of professionalism and skill and all the rest of it. What worries me the most is the systematic ways in which that can... When you had a city with three newspapers in it, and someone messed something up, the other ones would jump all over it. When you don't have that, then you've got there's no check whatsoever there. So as you limit those number of voices, there are fewer ways in which that can be fixed. By the way, one local bright spot. Do you guys watch the Ivory Tower on WCNY? I think that's a lot of what I know about local politics, I learn on that show. But that's, of course, an opinion show. But it's so sane, and it's so, you know, quiet. And I think it's a really good show. My old boss founded that show. Oh, sorry, I keep pointing to people.
Fascinating presentation. Thank you. I'm a real advocate and supporter of democracy, and I have great faith in the wisdom of the American people, or I had great faith in their wisdom.
There was a great joke, I think it was Saturday Night Live, where everybody kept saying, go out and vote, go out and vote, go out and vote. Well, maybe not you.
The faith is being shaken. And you know, I just used as an example something like the Clintons. It seems to me like the American people got Bill Clinton right. I mean, the politics, and it all sort of turned out all right in the end. And they got Hillary Clinton completely wrong. And as a result, I mean, I'm feeling like the American people are kind of being snookered by the media. And we need a new kind of media literacy to separate fact from fiction and fake news from real news and punditry from reporting. But I don't see that happening. I see more people getting into these ruts of their own preconceptions being confirmed, and we're not getting that corrective over time, and it really worries me. What do you think?
Yeah. Well, okay, first of all, the idea of the ruts is nothing new. I mean, we think of the real news idea of somehow this objective ideal, and that's relatively new. I mean, newspapers started as mouthpieces of political parties. We still got the remnants of the words Republican and Democrat in newspapers today. I think... The New York Post, wasn't that a Federalist, came out as a Federalist paper? Anyway, you'd get a paper with your when you joined the party kind of thing. It wasn't until the Penny Press came out when they then started to make their money by advertising and they wanted to be objective because they didn't want to offend anybody so they could maximize their sales and circulation and make the most with advertising. And then especially after the Second World War, or the First World War, and then with the press, the wire services might be in this paper, might be in this paper, so it was a more objective kind of thing. And then radio and TV put the seal on this when they were appealing to everybody. So by the time all of us came along, there was this idea that that's the way it ought to be. But a lot of journalism was party-oriented before that. So I don't think there's anything inherently wrong with those voices. But the only solution to it, I think the two words you use, is media literacy, which is to teach people that not only is the truth hard, as the New York Times says, but the truth is complicated, and the truth is often not even the truth. An apple and a banana, okay, that's simple enough. But after that, it gets complicated. So media literacy and really teaching people, I've been saying for 30 years, we teach kids to read, write, and do arithmetic. After 300 years of that curriculum, it's time to add something new, which would be how to manage that kind of information. But that would be a battle that had to be fought on 50 different fronts because you'd have to go through state boards of education or however that would be done. And then you'd have to get people who could actually teach that. And that is really, really hard. If you gave me the challenge right now to step into a high school classroom and teach people what they need to know to address the problem you just addressed, I'd be hard-pressed to do that effectively. That would be a really hard job that I don't think I've got the brains to do.
recall, yeah, you look at television as a cultural experience. And that's why you got hired by SU instead of some other places you wanted to teach at. So how does a person who is aging oh so gracefully understand how to find where the good culture is in the television landscape?
Well, thanks for that oh so gratefully, but you haven't looked here. I spend so much time now just keeping up with television. I mean, it used to be you'd watch the stuff on the networks in the fall, and then you'd have Christmas break for the reruns, and then you'd have the summer and everything. I try to keep up with all the new shows, but there are over 450, I think, scripted shows available right now, new ones. So, I mean, generally, I try to watch as much as I can, and if it's really good and interesting, then you know that's where it is. It's sort of like reading. You can't read all the books that ever come out, but you start to, you know, authors that you like, you know, various ways in which you can begin to sift it through. But part of my job is that I not only have to watch the good stuff, I have to watch the bad stuff as well. And I know, boo-hoo, you have to watch TV all day long. But my dad was a plumber. I guess I'm better off than that. But there are times that it really does seem like work. Do you have like favorite shows now? Are you watching some of this fancy stuff?
Well, occasionally. I mean, but there's some stuff. For example, I couldn't watch Mad Men because I lived it. I didn't need to watch.
Yeah. It's a documentary.
Same
here
with me
in
Sopranos.
Oh, my gosh. With me, it was Orange is the New Black. I got caught. You didn't.
To follow up on Sarah's question, what do you feel is like the future of what my own opinion, trash TV, like the Kardashians or the Real Housewives? Just a phase, I hope.
Unlike the news that we've been talking about, which we're worried about the future of good professional news, the future of the stuff you're talking about is bright, rosy, and it's all going to be fine. The Kardashians is an empire. It's been going on for a long time. 10 years from now, it won't be the Kardashians, but there is always going to be, I think, an appetite for that kind of stuff. I am amazed it took network television so long to figure that out. The real world starts in 92. Network TV doesn't do reality till 2000. And I have to say one of the reasons for that is probably our own fault as well. You don't have to raise your hands, but look deep into your hearts. Aren't there people out there who, for me, it was Temptation Island. Does anybody remember the show? On paper, the most heinous, horrible, vulgar idea you could possibly imagine. You get a bunch of couples who are together, and you bring them to this beautiful island, you separate them into two resorts, and you've interviewed all of them of who their perfect like types are, and you tempt them with people and try to break them up. It's a horrible idea. I'm embarrassed to even be explaining it. I love that show so much. I would cross off the days on the calendar until it would come on again. As stupid as this stuff is, it can be really compelling. Now, the Kardashians may not be your particular taste, but some of these things, as dumb as The Bachelor was, it was so much more familiar to American courtship ritual than a wonderful Tom Hanks romantic comedy with, what's her name, when they go to the Empire State Building and You Got Mail. Meg Ryan, right. Thank you. Those are nice, and they're more literate, and they're more human and sane, but American dating rituals are stupid, and they're insecure, and you behave badly, and all of that stuff. And you watch some of these shows, and you see that kind of it looks familiar. And sometimes stupid is just what the doctor ordered. No, Real Housewives of New Jersey is never going to get a Peabody Award. But sometimes when you're flying through the dial and you go, ooh, Handmaid's Tale, that's really thought-provoking. Ooh, Breaking Bad, that was brilliant. Oh, Real Housewives, that's what I feel like watching right now. I mean, some of this good stuff is just so hard to do. So I'm sorry to say, if you're holding your breath waiting for going away, you're going to turn blue and fall down because it is not going anywhere.
All right, so I would go back to talking horses, I think.
You know, that's another thing. Those, for what those things were, they were really good. If you go back and watch a Mr. Ed episode, it holds up amazingly well. I mean, those shows did what they did, as weird as it was, very, very nicely.
I loved Mr. Ed. dates us, doesn't it? Anyway, getting back to the need for more reporting of factual information locally. I'm curious about the fact, when I moved here 30 years ago, I everywhere I'd ever been had TV, the local TV showed the city council meetings, the county legislator meetings on the scrolling. Instead, we have the scrolling news that seems like it reminds me of, you know, before I was born. I'm curious, what do you see as the, has there been an impact of that in different communities in terms of the fact you can't even see these meetings on local television? Is there an impact of that? And then my second question is a more, perhaps a broader one, or for hoping for the future, is what do you see in terms of any kind of collaborations between disciplines in terms of journalism and other disciplines? Here in Syracuse, particularly at SU, we have a rich array of knowledge in many fields, and it just seems like with the increase in students getting degrees and multiple majors, minors, and things of that nature, do you see an increase in students becoming, you know, both an particularly in the sciences where we really need facts and we're not getting them necessarily in a broad sense, do you see some collaborations there, some opportunities? Is SU promoting that so that when we see science journalists, they are actually very knowledgeable and we can trust what they say?
Yeah, I'll do it. The first question I don't know as much about, so sorry about that. But that second one about science journalism is interesting. And at the Newhouse School, we actually have a science journalism program. And it is that idea that journalists are trained to, of course, report things and to systematically find, package, and make sense of information. But they have to do that in so many different fields, as you point out. One day they might be doing a story about a building that's collapsed, which requires architectural knowledge or fire prevention or whatever. And the next they're doing something on a, you know, Zika virus or something like that. So journalism, I think, has always been an interdisciplinary thing in that journalists are always going out and trying to find the people who know the most about what subject that they're covering. The idea of having actual trained scientists as journalists is a wonderful utopian idea, and I'm sure there are people out there who are really good at that, who might have aspirations for both. But there are always these little secrets that a lot of the people that end up in journalism is because it had fewer math requirements. That's kind of glib, but not totally untrue.
Thank you so much,
Bob,
for spending the day with us.
Thank you guys very much.